No, like, nobody to banter with. This is terrible. Hey, everybody, it's Kai, and just me, because Molly's on vacation, so you got me. It's Make Me Smart, podcast about tech, the economy, culture, and boy, I'm already missing Molly. But anyway, I won't say that anymore, because really, I'm not alone. I'm not alone. I've got all y'all, because as we all know, none of us is as smart as all of us. And in a second, actually, our China correspondent Jennifer Pack is going to be here because we are going to do a little bit of a deep dive into China today about what's going on there now and how it influences technology and culture and the economy in this country, because it really is. It's in the politics. It's in the economics. It's in pretty much everything. And it's interesting. The reason we wanted to do it, I specifically wanted to do this, was because I'm not sure that a lot of people in this country understand what it's like on the ground over there. And let me preface this by saying I was over there for 2 years back in the mid-90s, living there, working for the State Department. Have been back on work and family trips half a dozen times since then. And it's kind of an amazing place. So what we're going to do is we're going to get Jennifer on the line. We're going to talk about some of the changes in the past 20 years in that economy over her period of going in and out of that country, and then my impressions, and we'll see. But one of the things that kicked this whole thing off, actually, was an email from one of y'all. His name is Rick Munkaukas, and here's what he said.
Kai used to live in China. I want him to tell us what the Chinese culture is like, or maybe more significant, the Chinese government. And how about Jennifer Pack? She's there. What's it like? Is China a good or bad influence? I'd love to hear some kind of evaluation by Kai and maybe Jennifer as well.
I frankly think Jennifer Pack would do the better analysis because she's got more. First of all, she's got more experience in China than I do, but also she's got more current experience in China than I do. So, Jennifer Pack, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So let's do the thumbnail sketch of your experience in China, just so everybody knows what we're talking about.
Sure. I think if we could step back a bit just to address that listener's question directly. I happened to be speaking to an analyst, and I asked him that same question. Does America want a strong or weak China? And his answer is, we should probably reframe that question. So here's Xiong Peng with the Pangol Institution, a Beijing think tank.
I don't think Americans need a strong China or a weak China, just a rule-abiding China, or one that abides by American values. Right now, people are worried that the state is too powerful the way it runs the Chinese economy, and many of the state's practices are not recognized by the global community.
Man, there's a lot in there, which we will get to in due course. You've been coming in and out of China for what, like 15 years now, plus or minus?
Not quite, but thereabouts. I first came in 2006 to 2008, which was China's coming out party during the Beijing Olympics. And then I returned 2015, and I've lived in various cities in China.
Including, so you're in Shanghai now, but you were down in Shenzhen too, right? Which is sort of the Silicon Valley-ish place in that country?
Yeah. More specifically, they call it the Silicon Valley of hardware.
Right, because lots of things that we use in this country are actually built down there. Okay, so look, let me do that. Before we get to all those things the analyst said, which was great, and there's a lot in there to unpack, do me a favor and give me your impressions of the change in China from 2006 to today. Because my experience is that virtually every time I go back to that country, which is once every three-ish years, It's like a completely different place.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I was absent for about 6 years. And in that time frame between late 2009 to 2015, I came back and suddenly I can't really use cash anymore. And let me tell you, I tried very hard to resist mobile payments. I really did, because I was in Shenzhen where Tencent has its headquarters. Mm-hmm. That's the company that runs WeChat Pay, right? And I tried my best, but in the end, I had to give in because I was worried about privacy, my information going to this company, tracking me everywhere. But eventually, I had to give in. So that's the biggest change I can say, at least in the time I was away.
Here's something that got me. When I was in Shanghai, and this is now, when do we go back? 2015. You can stand in the middle of People's Park, in the middle of downtown Shanghai, right?
Yeah.
And if you swap out the guys selling green onion pancakes from the street carts with the guys selling hot dogs in New York City, you could be in the middle of Manhattan, because there's a Nike store, there's a Lamborghini dealer, there's an H&M, there's a Uniqlo, there's a Marriott hotel. It's really kind of stunning, because when I was there in 95 and 96, we spent Thanksgiving in Shanghai. And it was, you would look across the river, you know, you know how Shanghai has the Bund there, and it's on the Huangpu River.
Yeah.
You look across, and now it's just, it looks like Hong Kong. Back then, it was all cement factories and low rise, just nothingness. And it's crazy that that was only 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I'll bet it was hard to find a turkey, right?
Yeah. In point of fact, it was. We actually went to a seafood restaurant in Shanghai that night, and we were like, oh, this just is not right. This just isn't doing it.
But you're absolutely right. It's in that Shanghai is one of the richest cities, if not the richest city in China. And here you are looking at a place that is probably even more developed than places like New York. Now, I'm sorry to New Yorkers. I know people think that that New York is very fast moving and stuff, but I could tell you that the escalators here move faster.
Yeah.
Everything is so much more efficient on so many levels. And you can access so many brands. We're not just talking about American brands. You're talking about Southeast Asian brands coming in. You have Japanese brands, Korean brands, Middle Eastern brands, brands that I don't even think I have access to in North America. But here, you can access it. So you're right. Lamborghinis are here. You can see Buicks. You can see GM. I mean, the amount of spending is incredible. But, okay, that's only one China.
Yeah.
There is another China.
Yeah, But before you get outside Shanghai, I just want to give this a little nod here, because I was just in Manhattan about a week ago. Talk to me about the New York City subway versus the Shanghai subway, right? The Shanghai subway is amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yes, and it is efficient. It's extremely clean. And it's quite orderly, I have to say.
And it gets you where you want to go on time.
Exactly. And it's not even just the subway system. I could say that the bullet train system, that's a marvelous thing. Have you taken that?
I have, and it's extraordinary. And let me just tell you, just because I'm telling my East Coast stories, I was on the Acela from New York down to Philadelphia, and it was meh, you know. Anyway. All right. So there are two Chinas. So we got Shanghai, and it's gleaming, and it's amazing. And yes, there's all kinds of, you know, surveillance state and all of that stuff that we're going to get to in a minute. It's not all sunshine and light in Shanghai. But take me like an hour outside of town. What's it like in the countryside, which is most of China?
Yeah, exactly. So most of these places, you're probably not going to be able to find an American steak. It's not that convenient to get around. People are probably riding their motorbikes. Actually, what I found was they have these interesting electric, I don't know what they call it. It's sort of like a tin can on wheels. They're electric vehicles, and they're very quiet, but they're super efficient. They can kind of squeeze through the cars during traffic. So, because, you know, sometimes just to put numbers into context, we talk about China being the largest passenger car market, right?
Mm-hmm.
2018, we're talking about 28 million cars being sold. Mm-hmm. That sounds astounding, right? But that's a very, very tiny fraction of people who own cars. It's still very much, there's so many families here who have still not owned their first car. And did you know, I found out recently, that it's not really the price of the car that costs a lot. It's also the license plate, because in Beijing and Shanghai, it's based on a lottery system or an auction system, which can cost more than $10,000 to get. In addition to that, you have to get a driver's license that takes you a few months, mandatory, to get a driver's license. And then if you're getting an electric vehicle, you can bypass that queue and get a license plate. I thought that meant, you know, people were more willing to buy an electric vehicle. Well, not in Shanghai, because in order for you to get that electric vehicle, you have to prove that you own a parking lot in your own name, which means you have to buy a property.
Okay. So at least two different Chinas, right? You got the rural, not exactly prospering and thriving, and still where life is really hard. You got Shanghai, where life is probably increasingly expensive, but modern. What's the, and I'm going to ask you to paint a really broad brush here, right? What's the overall mood of the Chinese people that you run into day to day?
I would say that because the news is censored about the U.S.-China trade war, that a lot of people are still very much concerned about their daily lives. So young people, for example, first and foremost, they're worried about their education. And then next, they're worried about what happens after they graduate. not so much about finding jobs, because maybe they haven't entered the workforce yet, so they're not too worried. But they are concerned about buying property if they are not from Shanghai or the major cities, because that is where wealth is accumulated. You need a property to get married if you are a man. And all of that places a lot of pressure on young people today. So they're worried about bread and butter issues. They're worried about property. They are worried about earning money and saving money. And a lot of the people that I interact with in my daily life, they're not from Shanghai originally. So the people who are from Shanghai or from Beijing, their families have been here for, you know, a few decades. Well, they have property and they're pretty much set. As long as you're able to live with mom and pop, then everything else becomes a bit easier. But for the people, the hundreds of millions of people who are trying to make a living in the cities, they're sandwiched in between. They have come out here maybe 16, 20 years old, 30 years old. They're saving 80, 90% of their income that they're earning. All they do is work 6 days, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. That's pretty normal. Yeah. And all they want is to save enough money to go, I suppose, back to their hometown, because there is no hope for them to live in the major cities. And the reason why people want to come to the cities is not just for economic opportunities, but all of the best stuff is here. Schools, hospitals, all of the best resources are here.
So talk to me for a minute then about the not quite explicit, but broadly understood deal that has been made between the Chinese government and its citizens, which is we will give you some degree of economic autonomy. And this goes, you know, back to the days of Deng Xiaoping saying, you know, we're going to open it up a little bit. Talk to me about that deal between economic autonomy and lack of political rights.
Right. So as early as, say, the early 80s, pretty much everything was controlled by the Communist Party. So jobs were assigned, where you could go to school was determined, or whether you could go to school was determined. Even clothing, your limited choices in that, hairstyles, everything was controlled, okay? And actually, people would tell me that if they talked to somebody and they knew what their background was, they could pretty much figure out what each family was earning, which was not a lot, okay? So it might have been like under $10 a month, okay? But it was enough because the what they called the work unit, your employer, provided everything from apartments to maybe transportation, meals, you know, the basics. So that was all provided for. Gradually, by the time you came to China, that was starting to open up, right? Not fully yet, because they haven't signed on to the World Trade Organization, and so they haven't fully opened up, but already people were getting a bit more freedom. You know, before they couldn't get any music, Western music, to come in, and it wasn't even just American music, but they couldn't even get Taiwanese music or Hong Kong music. You know, they had to smuggle it in. All of that stuff, it started becoming easier. And as one analyst told me, people got distracted. So now you could buy all sorts of shiny things, any brands you could think of. Now you can order it online and get it within 24 hours or less. That is a massive, massive change is consumer choice. And also, more importantly, freedom of travel. That's a very important thing, because it really wasn't until 2001 when people could get ordinary passports. So they couldn't travel freely within China, and they really couldn't travel freely abroad. But now they can. You could see them in tour groups, right?
Yeah.
So that's a huge change, is that to give them what they see and what they think is going on in the outside world, they want to compare it to their peers abroad. But at the same time, as you said, yeah, there are political restrictions. I'm going to say that the majority of people, especially when it comes to internet censorship, they're not going to run up against this. So they don't really necessarily sense it. It doesn't mean that they are not aware of it, but Chinese people are inherently practical. So what they cannot change, why worry about it?
Talk to me then about some of the things we hear in this country about the Chinese government and the control it maintains over its citizens, right? The idea of a surveillance state, the idea of basically a social credit score based on your behavior, those things that the government does to control its citizens' behavior, even while giving them economic opportunity.
Right. So with the social credit system, people have likened it to the Orwellian system, right?
Explain a little bit what it is, Jennifer, because I'm sure a lot of people aren't quite sure.
Sure, exactly. Most people in China, a lot of people, especially in the countryside and rural areas, they don't have a bank account. Okay, they never did formal business. They don't have any financial footprint in the country. So what China wanted to do was create a system in which they could figure out who is trustworthy to do business with. So how it was explained to me was China came from a farming community. People were used to doing business with their neighbors, with their friends. They knew who so-and-so from which village, mm-hmm. right? Then suddenly the economy opened and now they're trading with strangers. Now, these strangers don't have a credit score. They don't know where they can go to figure out, is this person trustworthy? Should I do business with them? They don't know. And so that's what some of the people who originally suggested such a system came up with, which was a system, a credit score system that didn't just depend on finances, not just on your bank records or your transactions, but what about your behaviors? For example, if you jaywalk, whether you're sorting your garbage properly, that has not been fully realized, right? And there has to be something to be said is that right now there is no one score and they haven't decided mm-hmm. who is going to determine it yet. But there are private companies, for example, like Ant Financial from Alibaba through its mobile payment trying to create it. But that is by no means something to dictate whether somebody mm-hmm. could go into business, whether they're going to get a license or not. That has not happened yet. But the mm-hmm. worry is it could.
Pull back then for me for a minute, and let's talk about the U.S.-Chinese bilateral relationship. In light of the trade war and in light of the technology disagreements that these two countries are having with Huawei and 5G technology and this idea of the digital iron curtain, where does that go? Given that globalization is happening no matter what the Trump administration tries to do, and China is going to be a big part of it.
Well, at the moment, China, while President Trump is saying whatever he's saying, in China, the leadership here is sending a message, even down to the city levels, that it's very much open to foreign businesses. This is the message that they've consistently said. And they point to things like Tesla now building the first foreign-owned factory here mm-hmm. in Shanghai. They point to big investments from ExxonMobil, all of that stuff to show that they are open to foreign businesses. What American businesses on the ground really want is a level playing field. Okay, mm-hmm. So there are rules in China, but it's really the unwritten rules that are really tough to get around. And if you are a state-owned company, you might get wind of it first. If you are a private Chinese company, you might sort of know how to find through your own channels what the information is. But if you're a Western company, if you're an American company, it's very tough, right? And these things can change from day to day, right? I did a story about video games, right? Yeah. Everyone thought it was a booming market, it's the biggest one, all that, all the superlatives. But then suddenly the government just decided, the regulator decided, we're not going to approve any more new games. Boom. It's gone. It's shut. And nobody knew when it was going to be lifted. Nobody knew what happened. You couldn't figure it out. So you just had to sit and wait. And in the meantime, what, 300-400 companies were estimated to have just mm-hmm. collapsed mm-hmm. from that, right? And so American firms are kind of looking for some clarity. They want more transparency in what is happening. Certainly there are American businesses that are winning, quote unquote, meaning that they, of course, are selling more to China. Mm-hmm. And you will hear that they are expanding their operations. So whatever they're manufacturing or producing in China and selling to the Chinese consumer, that part of the business is going to continue to grow. But if they have to manufacture in China and was sending it abroad, that stuff, they're probably moving to Southeast Asia or right. trying to diversify and right. find other plants to do it, right? So that's sort of what they're doing. Chinese companies also want a good relationship to happen between the two countries because they know it has been beneficial. But what has been very interesting is that through all of this complaints about the Chinese system, mm-hmm. Private companies in China, they are very much in favor of it because these are the same things that other foreign companies and they themselves have been complaining about. So it's really sort of the rest of the world versus state-owned companies that are sluggish, that are not turning a profit, but they are job creators. And this is why the Communist Party hangs on to them so closely. and why it's so difficult for them to let go. Huawei itself is not a state-owned company, but certainly, of course, people feel it is aligned. And it very well could be, because there are so many things on a day-to-day basis to do business in China. You need the government approval to do so. And they could stop you at every point. It could be custom checks. It could be a license approval. It could be your taxes. Maybe they change the rules. You know, all of that stuff could block you, and they'll never tell you very openly, oh yeah, this is because of the trade war. So a lot of American businesses are kind of bracing themselves because they know they're worried. You know, are my visas going to be tied up? Is it going to take longer? Because nobody will tell you. And that feeds into this whole censorship system and the system of control, is that people are instilled with this sort of fear of the unknown. You never quite know where the lines are. And so you kind of self-censor. And that's the most effective part of this whole system, is that people self-censor.
So look, I'm going to let you go in a minute because it's super late at night over there, but spitball this for me. Just to get us back to the trade war and the current state of play in the most important economic relationship in the world. The Trump administration is asking the Chinese government to make fundamental changes in the way its economy works. And it's threatening tariffs on virtually everything that the United States imports from China. Do you think Xi Jinping, the president of China, responds to that and makes the changes? Can he make the changes? Or are we just going to be bumping along here for a long time in this current sort of trade unease?
I think it'd be the latter. Just because President Trump has been, really? I mean, listen, China is on its own course, right? It makes its own economic plans and it makes it 5, 10 years, you know, 15 years in advance, right? So it's going to plod along. And
which is really funny because American trade policy now gets made at the drop of a tweet, truly.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And that's what's spinning the head of the Chinese leadership, is because they were basing it on some predictability about America.
Yeah.
but now they can't.
Right.
And actually, what they have done is, for example, downplayed a lot of the stuff that people might interpret as China on the rise, being threatening. So they have clamped down on any kind of propaganda about Made in China 2025. Do you really think that all of those plans are stopped? No. Right? It just means that they're going to slow it down a bit, but they're going to continue to develop. And even right at the start of tit-for-tat tariffs, people on the street, who, by the way, who are not following this very closely, they automatically told me without fail that this is about keeping China from rising. This is what they really do believe. They said, America's feeling insecure, so they don't want us to do well. That's basically it. Yeah, so they saw it from a mile away. And now the leadership is sometimes parroting this, you know, that we will not stop our own rise for the Americans. So that's really not going to stop. What I will say is some of the points, especially when it comes to IP tech transfer, intellectual property protection, that stuff, Chinese authorities have been talking about it. They are moving towards it, or they did have the intention to. The issue is that there is a concern that since President Xi Jinping came into power, some of that has stalled or maybe even stopped. And that's why when you're talking to people about what it's like in China, you know, even between you and me, we're seeing very, very different Chinas, because it depends on when we were here in the country, which city we were in, and things are changing all the time. So, you know, for our listener who's trying to figure out, like, you know, what should I believe when I'm reading it? I will tell you that whatever you're reading that is good, most of it probably is true in China. But whatever you're reading that is bad also exists in China. And those two do coexist. And when it comes to the system and control, the last thing I wanted to say, somebody explained it to me and I thought this was pretty good, which is when China was in the 80s or starting out, before the economic reforms, think of China as being under this box, right? And it was very tightly controlled. It was a very small box. Gradually, over the last 40 years, they have loosened and they have expanded this box. So people are not running up against the edges as much. Okay? And so people feel there are far more freedoms than before. And they're happier with their daily lives. And that's not for nothing. You have people who are over the age of 60 who remember not having enough to eat, who remember starvation, right? And then you suddenly have their children or even their grandchildren suddenly studying in the U.S. or being born in the U.S., having a U.S. passport. That is a massive amount of change. The question and the issue right now is some people worry that this expansion is slowing down or stopping. And in fact, that box is contracting mm-hmm. again. So that's really what's at play here.
Jennifer Peck is Marketplace's correspondent in Shanghai. She's been there for a while. I was there for a while. Amazing insights. Jennifer, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Kai. It's been fun.
All right. You bet. We'll talk to you soon. Anybody out there who's listening who has experience in China, if you've lived there, if you've worked there, if you've gone over there on vacation, drop us a voicemail, would you? Let us know what you think. It's makemesmart@marketplace.org. And tell us about your experiences, what you thought about what Jennifer said. It's a totally fascinating topic, and it's going to be for the foreseeable future in this economy and in this country, for sure. All right, quick break, and then we'll be back. All right, we're back. No, wait. I'm back because it's just me all by my lonesome. So we are not, just because it's no fun to bat this stuff around with myself. And if I don't have Molly here as a foil, then I am not talking about what's in the news. I'm just not doing that. We are going to go instead straight to y'all. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, so we're going to do a bunch of slightly different but different, slightly related things. We talked about CEO compensation last week as part of a semi-ongoing series we're going to do about economic inequality, and that in itself an extension of our conversation about whether or not capitalism is working for enough people. We talked about Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, and I said at one point, you know, not everybody on this planet can run a company like Disney. Ronnie Colvin from Madison, Alabama. Whoo boy, disagrees.
That framing presumes that Bob Iger is some sort of uber genius, coming up with all the ideas himself and doing all the underlying work to make it happen, and that's just not true. Nobody is capable of single-handedly running the company on a day-to-day basis, coming up with all the creative ideas, the mergers and acquisitions, all new lines of business, etc.
That is totally true. Totally true, Mr. Colvin. I guess my point was that marshaling all of that takes a skill set that maybe not everybody on this planet has. But yeah, Bob Iger's not running Disney, like figuring out, you know, what part goes where and all that. He's in charge of the whole thing. And that was my point. Let's see. All right. We talked soccer. I did anyway. World Cup and women's pay and all that stuff. Speaking of which, the United States plays England today, probably after you have downloaded this or before you've downloaded this, by the way. Anyway, so gender pay gap was what I talked about. Suzanne Martinez had some thoughts.
I'm a huge fan of the show, but I wanted to point out and ask, why do we need to say Women's World Cup and not just World Cup? There's only one going on right now. We don't ever say the Men's World Cup. I've consciously made the change thanks to someone else pointing this out.
I guess that's true. I'm trying to think of, like, we do say women's figure skating versus men's figure skating when we're talking about the Olympics, you know? I don't know. Food for thought. I don't know. We'll see what I do. Anyway. Okay. Make Me Smart question wraps it up for us. Ruha Benjamin is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. She's also the author of the new book, Race After Technology. The question, of course, is what is something you thought you knew, but then found out you were wrong about? Here's her answer.
Something I didn't know that I now get is that robots, even racist robots, have something to teach us. I know that technology doesn't just impact society, but that people also shape technology in all kinds of ways. The more I documented this two-way relationship between society and technology, and more specifically between systemic racism and machine bias, I began to realize that this still didn't get at everything. That it's more than just a two-way relationship. It's an ongoing feedback loop. Now, the very tools that we're creating to supposedly make life easier, more efficient, even more fair, are reflecting back at us these very social hierarchies. Our little baby robots, we might say, are sexist, classist, and racist. our past decisions are being projected into the future and being called neutral. This seemingly neutrality is what makes these digital systems potentially more dangerous than racist practices of a previous era. From Jim Crow to new Jim Crow to now the new Jim Code, which is coded inequity coupled with imagined objectivity. And so what I've learned over the last few years is technology doesn't just have the potential to save us or slay us, but it has something to teach us as well, but only if we're willing to look honestly at the tools we're designing.
So that last bit is the key right there, right? First of all, that was Ruha Benjamin out of Princeton University. Her new book is Race After Technology. Let me channel my inner Molly Wood. Algorithms, and thus robots in some way, are written by humans, and they carry the biases that we all carry. Anyway, how's that to end the program? You guys think about that for a little while. On the way out, I will mention this. We have a new newsletter. As Molly has said a bunch of times, makes you smarter throughout the whole week. You can sign up at marketplace.org/newsletters. Otherwise, we're out of here. Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Mars. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Special thanks this week to Jody Becker. Those of you who try to listen to us on YouTube, well, we didn't get it done this week. Sorry. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by that very same Ben Tolliday. Also, Daniel Ramirez, the executive director of On Demand. This is Tar Nieves, the senior vice president and general manager around these parts. Is Deborah Clark, who, as we know, listens all the way to the end. I got nothing. I can't riff by myself. Molly Wood. That's all I got. It's a little sad, actually. It's a little pathetic. It's a little pathetic. Go ahead, say it. Say it. Kai, you're pathetic. That's a whole different podcast. That's my new podcast, Kai, you're pathetic. How about that? Kai, you're pathetic. I'll go with that.